pipe benders, struggling with a copper.
In different parts of the country, the work of forgotten and unrecognized avant-garde artists is being unearthed. For many years, the legacies of these artists have been submerged, but now their music and art is surfacing. Their names are Cuivín Bratnach, Zaftig Gyula, the Keening Women's Alliance, and others. They have little in common, apart from spending their lives making art far beyond the prevailing cultural winds. To me, they're like bog bodies. Some are intact, some just about recognizable. And they were always there, even if we didn't know it.
What he believed, I think, is that all of our subconscious places are connected to a greater subconscious, an earthly subconscious, and that he could tune in to what was going on just beneath the kind of the skin of the earth.
They did create a type of vortex, you know, of sound and feeling, and I was definitely, you know, in that with them, and I guess I felt a bit transformed.
I'm Tom Rosengrave, and I'm a radio producer, writer, and performer. My curious ear has led me to experimental and outsider music and art in different countries around the world, but rarely to Ireland. So when I came upon the website of a group calling itself the Avant-Garde Archive of Ireland, I was first curious and then completely fascinated. The name of this archive is Aisteach, an Irish word meaning strange or odd. They work to preserve the legacy of 20th century Irish avant-garde artists, mostly composers, though some work in visual media. Their work offers new possibilities for interpreting our lives and landscape, and continues to influence artists today.
I always find cows to be the most beautifully surreal images in the landscape, especially with the extremely vivid green, and then you have this incredibly dramatic grey skies of varying shades.
In this programme, I want to meet the people working to preserve the legacies of these figures. I want to understand who the artists are and why their art has been marginalised. I'm also curious about the work of a living archive, as Aisteach calls itself. What does that mean? And to ask a stupid question, what's the difference between Aisteach and a storage unit? But ultimately the question for me is, why should we save this art from the passage of time? Because time is a busy man. And he's wearing a gilet. And he doesn't much care for your weird art. I travel to Roscommon, where I meet Jennifer Walsh, the current president of the Aisteach Foundation. Jennifer is a hugely original voice in new music across the world, and is one of Ireland's most important and influential composers. As president of Aisteach, Jennifer has extended the archive's reach well beyond its premises in Dublin too. She established the archive's website, edited a print anthology on its artists, and was behind the Aisteach exhibition at the Model Gallery in Sligo in 2018. I meet Jennifer at the home of her late uncle Cuivín Bratnach, an outsider artist whose work is now preserved by the archive. The house is on a site near the village of Knockvicar in North Roscommon, and is surrounded by a stream on one side and woodland on all others.
Hi Tom, come on in.
Hello.
If you don't mind, can you kick your shoes off?
We'll do, yeah.
Farm and all, you know.
Yeah.
You've probably seen the pigs outside there.
Yeah.
Jennifer has offered to be our guide as we enter into the Aisteach catalogue.
My name is Jennifer Walsh. I'm a composer and an artist, and I'm the president of the Aisteach Foundation. For me, as a composer, what I found growing up in Ireland was that when I looked to see, you know, music by Irish composers, there is definitely a wealth of music by Irish composers, but what I couldn't find so much was stuff that was experimental, avant-garde. That seems to be missing. And you look back and there definitely were Irish composers, gifted people like, you know, I think of like Rhoda Coggill or Enid Boyle, but what I often found I couldn't, growing up, what I couldn't find was the weird avant-garde experimental music. I could find that in literature very easily. I could read Flann O'Brien and James Joyce and Samuel Beckett, but it was less available to me. And if you look at the Encyclopedia of Music in Ireland, which, you know, is an amazing undertaking, there's no chapters on free jazz, there's no chapters on free improvisation or noise music or Dada or Fluxus or any of these other art movements. And so my search for that and my search to try and find those people, because they must have existed. That's what I felt. That's what led me to being involved with Aistheach.
Jennifer's connection to Aistheach was deepened after she discovered recordings, scores and drawings belonging to her great uncle after his death. They had been stored in bin bags in the attic and had never been played or exhibited publicly. Jennifer was stunned by their originality and donated them to Aistheach.
I had a sense, given that, you know, you look at the writers Ireland was producing, like Joyce and Beckett and O'Brien, who I just mentioned, I had the sense there has to have been people thinking on these lines. Now, it's hard to know, because there may be people who came up with ideas and schematics for pieces or wrote music, but it may just never have made the light of day. And it's not even that it wasn't archived, it's just that people didn't know it existed. And so that was sort of strongly my feeling, that there must have been people. You couldn't have had a country that had that sort of level of creative imagination to do with literature without it also being there in art and sound.
There are simple and complicated reasons for the avant-garde shaped hole in our cultural heritage. I spoke to Dr. Mark Fitzgerald, Senior Lecturer of Music at TU Dublin, about the shape and size of this void in 20th century Irish composition.
A lot of essential and very basic infrastructure was completely lacking. So starting at the very beginning, the first thing is education. There wasn't widespread access to the sort of musical education that would introduce people to the sort of art music that we're talking about, whether it be even relatively conservative but recent art music or more avant-garde music. If you think about the type of access that did exist, it was limited really to people with the money who would be able to study at somewhere like the Royal Irish Academy of Music. And so that instantly disenfranchises a huge swathe of the population. You also have to take into consideration that a lot of the people involved in music in the early 20th century might have come to their music education via institutes like the Church of Ireland. So studying the organ and studying compositional techniques with people who were organists and masters and choristers in the cathedrals and so on. And obviously the sort of musical milieu in which they are working is a very conservative one and very far removed from what we might describe as a modernist idiom.
We head outside and Jennifer shows me the landscape that served as the inspiration for her great-uncle's work. It's a difficult task to categorise the art of Caoimhín Branach, but one notable point is his lack of distinction between the natural world and the artistic product. Probably the best example of this is his subliminal tape series. It's a collection that saw him recording found sounds onto cassettes and then subjecting the cassettes to natural processes like burning or burial.
He was very interested in manipulating the cassettes as physical objects. So sometimes he would bury them according to periods in the astronomical calendar that he felt had certain portents or certain meaning for him. He would also dig holes in the field and bury the cassettes just with like different objects wrapped around them to sort of infuse them. He would do things like expose them to different odors or smokes or times of the day. But the whole point was that the sounds on the tape would somehow be changed through these sort of magical occult processes, so that when you listen to these sounds or you were in proximity to them, even to the tapes as physical objects, they'd have a healing effect. They'd have some sort of effect on your psyche or on your biology. So it was his own system that he developed of correspondences. It's quite arcane. It's difficult to unpick exactly what he thought was happening, as difficult as many alchemical or occultist or magical systems.
Wearing loose, comfortable, warm clothing.
This is Subliminal Tape 86,
lie down flat on your back and relax.
But this is just the sonic part of it. The other part is the cassette itself, the material half of the artwork, which Branagh called the sonic object. By subjecting the cassette to the environment, Branagh's concept was to create a symbiosis between nature and sound. It was a highly original process in the Irish art making of the time.
It seems like he wanted to kind of fuse the music he was making quite literally with the landscape around him.
Oh, definitely, definitely. So you had this sense that there's this sort of biology and technology being, or like organic matter, you know, or stones, holy water, seawater, moss, leaves, fire, all these things, and the tape is coming into contact with them. I mean, that makes total sense. If you look here, we're standing by these woods, which the trees are completely covered in moss, you know, all the way up the trunks, they're completely covered in moss. So you have this landscape where things are encroaching on one another, you know, you notice things in the landscape, any shift in the landscape, especially if you're here during the winter when it can be a bit relentless and grey and rainy, you notice any sort of shift in the landscape.
Branagh never achieved recognition in his lifetime. Even if he had engaged with artistic groups, it's unclear what kind of a reception his work would have received. There was little room in Ireland for progressive composition of this kind.
I think that it's very important for composers to experience a wide range of practice. And I'd say that one of the problems in Ireland was that you generally did not get performances of things which were modern or avant-garde. And, you know, one can think of many examples of that. I don't think anyone would call the Writer's Spring avant-garde today. It certainly was when it was written in 1913, but it didn't get a performance in Dublin until the 1960s. And if you take something like Berg's Vatsek from 1925, it still has not received an Irish performance. So in terms of live experience of the music, that was a big problem for a lot of composers. And unless they had some direct personal contact themselves by travelling abroad or by encountering some figure from abroad, then they were very much cut out of that development line.
The term outsider artist has been retrospectively applied to Branagh. It's an institutional term and a sloppy categorisation in itself.
He made work. That was just who he was in the world. It was how he negotiated the world, how he lived his life. And I suppose that's something that I feel he has in common with a lot of the other people in Ashtock. It's almost as if they make the work because they couldn't help it, because that's just who they are, and it's how they negotiate the world, is that they make their work. And I think that's something beautiful. It's the reason why most artists go to art school or go to music school. You know, they go because they've loved doing this since they were kids. And the sad thing is quite a lot of people lose that real love along the way, or people maybe who make art that wouldn't be considered of a very high standard, or they make stuff that's very avant-garde, that love is beaten out of them or made fun of until they lose sight of it.
We head back inside and I ask Jennifer what she considers the purpose of an archive to be.
I'm very aware that the function of any archive will be to, without meaning to, commit the same sort of errors that any archive will, which is to deem certain things worth archiving and certain things not worth archiving. But ultimately, the purest definition of what an archive is going to do is just trying to save things that might disappear otherwise. So keeping hold of things that we think are worth keeping hold of, and trying to make them available for people who might not have known they existed, or who might not know that they need them until the day they come across them.
We say our goodbyes and Jennifer promises to introduce me to some of her collaborators in Ashtock. Her first suggestion is that I meet a London-based musicologist who has written extensively about a pioneer of electronic music in Ireland.
I'm Stephen Graham. I'm a lecturer in music at Goldsmiths College, and I specialise in contemporary classical and popular music.
Dr. Graham has published academic articles on numerous Ashtock figures, as well as helping locate scores and recordings. The figure that fascinates him most is Zaftig Gyula. Born Frank Carr, his musical education began as a session fiddler at local dance halls. But as Dr. Graham explains, his focus soon changed from the music to the sound world of these dances. And it was something he could articulate with an emerging technology. The dance halls for Zaftig were a place of trancing.
So he's born in 1906 in Monavay, a village just outside Galway. In his teens, early teens, he starts playing the fiddle. So we're talking the late 1910s, 1920s at this point. The music surrounding him is very much a form of social ritual. So he's making music and he's very much at the center of these events. But because he's a musician, he's also somewhat on the periphery because he's not part of the event as a participant. He's part of the event as a sort of an entertainer, if you like. So this practice gives him a real sense of both insider and outsiderdom. The trancing was very much, as you find in shamanistic traditions, for example, not just a product of the sort of what we would call the musical instruments. So in that case, rattles and drums, and in Zaftig's case, accordions, tin whistles, fiddles. They were at the center of the actual sound production. But what you also get as a sort of an atmospheric acoustic of feet stamping, sounds whelping, yelping, laughing. You also get a kind of a kinetic sense in the room that everyone is sort of being transported slowly and then suddenly into this sort of parallel state of consciousness. And that sort of mixture of music with sonics and sound, with movement and affect, really sows the seeds for what he would later go on to produce in his work later on.
When the future arrived in Monavay, it came in the form of radio. In 1926, Zaftig gathered at the parish hall to hear the first radio broadcast on 2RN, the new Irish public network. The voice of President Douglas Hyde arrived to the hall like an apparition. It was somehow both here and there.
It's me, dear. This is Zaftig Shan of the old, in more of the dead, who in area castles the larger of the Kutahane.
This idea of recording and transmitting sound became an obsession. Frank Carr acquired his own radio set and changed his name to Zaftig after hearing the word on a Yiddish radio broadcast. His own music making began when he bought a Presto Model K. It was a portable recorder which allowed him to capture the sounds of his environment and cut them to record.
He suddenly realised the potential of this Presto Model K. And he brings it along to various social occasions and rituals across the west of Ireland, using the network of contacts he built up through his experience as a fiddler. He goes to funerals, he goes to weddings, he goes to the kinds of dances he would have been performing in a few years previously. And he records them. Well, there's a sort of a dual purpose here. One is, yes, it's just serving a documentary purpose of getting these sounds down on tape. But he also, the secondary purpose here is that he starts to understand that there's a kind of a haunting that happens with these recordings, where he makes the recording and when he listens back to it, he's able to hear not just what was going on, but all these sort of ghosts in the machine. So he suddenly gets the sense of this piece of technology as being this portal, if you like, into the kinds of non-ordinary states, into the kinds of trancing states. And then later on, he would start to think of these as sort of psychedelic states, if you like.
Zaftig moved from making field recordings to manipulating them. He scratched and distorted the records in the hope of recreating the haunted, trancing atmosphere of the dance hall. In the early 1950s, he acquired a reel-to-reel recorder and combined tape loops with other sounds, inventing what he called a futurism of the fen and bog. His compositions are relations to the musique concrète of Pierre Schaeffer and the Groupe de Recherche Musicale in Paris. Yet it's unclear whether this influence is direct. Only one composition survives from this time. It's called Prismatic Sounds.
He makes this piece, 4 minutes of which survive to us today, called Prismatic Sounds. This is a very unusual piece in that it is made from a combination of recording of sort of squelchy and wheezy bog sounds, so air going through someone stepping on a bog. And so he makes this recording, and then he manipulates the tape, so he cuts it up, he makes loops out of it, and he builds those loops as the basis for this piece. He adds on his noise boxes, he adds on some whooshing theremin sounds here and there, and he makes this sort of collage. When you look at avant-garde traditions, for example, and you don't necessarily have one in your own country, it can feel very alienating in a way, because you don't have a story that you can read yourself into. And so you start to see your own life as very localized and sort of subcultural and defined by local conditions. But when you hear about a person like Zaftig in the past, who was sending out vapor trails to Europe and, in a way, drawing Ireland together with the global unconscious, that says to me that actually Ireland is part of the cosmology of Earth and not just part of its own, sometimes very sad, history.
Zaftig's work is defined by his technological experimentation. Yet there are other Aisteach artists who looked back in order to go forward. I want to discover how they found new meaning in ancient practices. Jennifer Walsh.
One thing that Irish people or Irish culture has been very good at is sort of hacking things to make them fit. We had mythological sites that Catholicism plonked churches down on top of, you know, to sort of hack paganism to try and make it work for Catholicism to sort of take root in the country. And Irish people have that sort of attitude. They will make things fit the way that they want to fit, and they can sort of hold cognitive dissonances lightly and use the landscape in ways which gives them some meaning or helps them navigate their way through the world. You know, in the UK, they talk about this genre of folk horror. And so your films like The Wicker Man or Penda's Fen, that's really about this sort of fear of paganism in the landscape. Irish people have no sense of folk horror because it's something that we live with happily. You know, we're not afraid of it. We're not afraid of mixing pagan things in with religious things, even if people have completely discarded religion, and just sort of making them into weird rituals that work for people.
What are these for? Are these old or new?
I'm back in the West with Jennifer to visit Alice Maher, one of Ireland's foremost visual artists. She works across a range of media, sculpture, painting and installation, and is also interested in the remoulding of traditional practices. It's something she shares with a group she's championed within the Aisteach Archive. I'm curious to know where these practices sit within an avant-garde and what we can take from them today.
My name is Alice Maher. I am a visual artist, and we're now sitting in my studio in Cluny, Partry, County Mayo.
Alice's association with Aisteach began through a private keening session she attended on Achill Island. After the session, she learned that the lead keener's mother had led a radical feminist keening group in the 1950s and 60s in Cork, known as the Keening Women's Alliance. Alice wanted to find out more and discovered that the material documenting their performances is held in the Aisteach Archive.
What I always understood by keening was that it was a practice that happened at funerals. You know, and that these were women in particular who were paid to come and grieve for the family or for the grieving person, who would just sit there, you know, not making any contribution, but that this keening person would kind of out all the emotion for the whole family and cry and weep. And, you know, that would be the end of it.
There are no surviving recordings of original keeners. However, in 1955, American ethnomusicologist Sidney Robertson Cowell recorded an unidentified Aran woman singing a version of a keen. Keening comes from the Irish word cuine, to cry. Keeners were traditionally employed as part of the funerary rites, to lament in song the virtues of the dead person and the sorrow of those left behind. The Catholic Church didn't approve, of course, and by the mid-20th century, keening had disappeared at Irish funerals. Yet private keening practices are known to exist in certain parts of the country. After a concert on Achill Island, Alice met a woman called T.P. McCabe, who leads a private group who keen as a healing practice.
She gave me her number, or I must have given her my number, and she called me and she said that they were having a get-together in about 2 weeks' time or something in her place in Achill Island, would I like to come along. So, you know, she told me a little bit about it, you know, that they were like this keening association of women. And I said, you mean like for funerals, like you keen at funerals? And she was like, no, it's a different practice for us. And she told me a little bit about it, that they were kind of influenced by her mother, who was kind of an avant-garde person in the 60s called Shauna McCabe. So I was like, yeah, okay. And so anyway, I get in the car and drive over to Achill and found her house. It's like a kind of a modern house. You know, it wasn't a cottage or anything like that. So it looked out on the sea, you know, these lovely windows. And then gradually these other people started arriving, 4 or 5 women. And then she introduced me to them and sat down. And you know, they sat down for a while and then suddenly everybody just went quiet, first of all. And then they kind of started, first of all, start moving left and right like this. It was like a type of shaking, or not shaking, but leaning left and right, shall we say. And then bit by bit, the sound started to come out of them. Now, they were sitting down first when they started, you know, all 5 of them. But then bit by bit, because they were moving and shaking left and right, they stood up. Then the next thing is they're swirling around. And I was completely, you know, agog. So the women, you know, were swirling around and these sounds were coming out of their throats, and they seemed to get like louder and louder and make kind of sounds that I never really heard human voices making. And I think it's because they were all doing it at the same time. You know, they started off kind of one by one and then became this kind of one sound, and they were swirling around. Now, T.P. herself, she didn't have long hair. She had short hair, but like me. But a couple of the other women had long hair, and they were loosing their hair and like shaking their hair around. And eventually it kind of reached kind of climax, and then they all sat down and then it was all over. The sounds themselves seemed to have meaning, if you know what I mean. So, and they came from deep within kind of the human body. So it was like they were calling up the human body to be outside itself, which is something I'm very interested in too, you know, in terms of drawing. How do you actually make a drawing of the human body that expresses the interior body, not just what it looks like from the outside? You know, not copying what you see in front of you, but actually expressing what is physically inside of you.
Inspired by the Keeners, Alice made a sculpture entitled The Shout, which was displayed at the Ashtag exhibition at the Model Gallery in Sligo. The piece is a cast of an open mouth, the threshold between the inner and the outer body.
I'm holding The Shout by Alice Maher, which is very, very heavy, mm-hmm. because this is a bronze casting.
Yes.
And you were saying, so bronze is always going to be extremely heavy.
Yes.
You know, this is very much, I don't know, it sort of, to me, it almost flickers in that I can see it as a mouth in pain, a mouth screaming, a mouth that's authoritative. All these different sort of emotions can play across it. It's sort of mobile in that sort of way to me, even though it's cast in bronze.
And it's like a little doorway too, isn't it, when you look at the mouth there? The mouth is like an opening, you know, into the other world or into the interior world, as far as I'm concerned. Yeah. And that's where you block people as well. And you don't allow them to open their mouth and speak or sing or keen or, you know, whatever they want to do.
The Shout is proof of the persistence of ancient practices, given new life by fresh interpretations. These practices surfaced in the Keening Women's Alliance of the 1950s and 60s, and now among the Achill women.
When I think about this idea of things being passed on and things going through the subconscious, I think it should be stressed. It's not something genetic. And I think sometimes these ideas are there and they're just there to be accessed, and they come and they're passed down in weird ways, and they don't pass in direct through lines. Things eddy and float back and then take weird little detours, but that they're there when people need them.
Yeah, and you receive them in different ways. I know, you know, I'm really interested in, you know, mythology and folklore and everything, but I never care if it's the real story. You know, some people are very particular and they go, no, that's not the story of Daphne and Apollo. And I go, I don't care. That's the story for me. You know what I mean? So I like it when people change things, and I like it when people add things and embroider things. And that's the way culture is passed down.
When thinking about an archive, we tend to overemphasize the past and forget about its role in the present. There is a healthy community of avant-garde artists working in Ireland today. To me, it seems that they must have the strongest affinity to the archive. I decided to meet two of these artists in the wild. They're both composers, and I'm curious to know what they might share, if anything, with their forebears.
Hello, how are you?
I visit Sebastian Adams in a Dublin City Council studio, which has served as his workspace for the past few months. Sebastian is a composer, viola player, and, along with Robert Coleman, the co-director of the contemporary music ensemble Kirkos. His work sits mostly at the intersection of music, performance, and installation art.
I think there's a case to be made that contemporary classical music in general, and also all kinds of experimental music are seen by many, both in the public and kind of in arts organisations, as being not at the centre of culture in Ireland, and not necessarily of great importance or relevance to a kind of Irish cultural or societal identity, which I think that is probably partly responsible for some of the disparities you see in terms of funding within our sector, but also it places us really in a niche. I studied in Austria for a while, and you know, classical music is everywhere there, and that means that the experimental end of classical music is the experimental end of something that is, you know, really important to the people. So, of course, it's on the fringes, but it kind of figures, whereas in contemporary classical music, I often feel the need that I actually need to explain what that is if I'm talking to somebody who I haven't met before, which I think is, you know, it's a sign of we are very much to the left of the mainstream.
London-based Anya O'Dwyer is a harpist, vocalist, and improviser. Her work is distinguished through the particularities of instrument and performance space. Anya's album Galleray was recorded in the shaft of the Brunel Tunnel, 70 feet beneath the Thames River in London. It has an acoustic decay of 3 to 4 seconds.
I would see the space that I perform in and compose in as, I guess, being a collaborator, the space as a collaborator. I like the idea of allowing an environment to be part of the compositional elements involved. The live event is something extremely special, but a lot of the time, if something is quite firmly and succinctly composed, which is beautiful in itself, there's a whole other element that's not allowed to breathe.
Something that preoccupies artists then and now is the concern that their work might not make it out of the desk drawer.
I worry all the time about whether my music will be heard and who by and how. It's one of the big things for composers. Most pieces we write only get played once, and so it can be this thing of, like, if there's a bad audience for a brilliant piece, maybe, in fact, that probably the best piece I've ever written, there's no recording that can be used in public, so 50 people heard it, maybe, and chances are they'll be the only 50 people who ever hear it, which is terrible.
Connection can be found in the sense that these paths have long been trodden.
It's like a beautiful gift, actually, knowing that these people existed, these composers and artists, and it paves the way for me, while allowing me still to try and break through. It's lovely to be able to have the breath and the space to move in various different ways. There are grandmothers and our grandfathers, for example, who were paving the way for us. Yeah, I find it really inspiring and a gift, actually, to know that they've existed.
I make the trip to the West one last time to meet Jennifer in Sligo. We're at the home of writer Kevin Barry, who has recently donated an important collection of material relating to an artist, still living, who's local to him in South County Sligo. And it's fitting we're in Yeats country because, in a sense, this is an artist working from the inside. His work challenges the interpretive hold that Yeats and other canonical figures have on the landscape here.
I think that there's a lot of fictions about Ireland, and Celtic revivalism is equally like a world-building fiction as any other. If you think at the moment we live in a world where most of the movies that are released are within the Marvel comic universe, and so in order to understand movies, you have to sort of understand all the nested relationships within this massive world-building project of Marvel comics. We're starting to sort of, or maybe understand, that a lot of history is a similar exercise in world-building. You know, people decided to tell a type of story from a certain perspective, and they put emphases on certain themes or certain people or certain events. And so I think that, like, there's always going to be weird anomalies and flaws or things that don't make sense. You know, like, if you think of even Yeats, you know, Yeats wrote a lot of his poetry in London, dreaming of Holy Wells and Sligo, you know, and those are sort of quite interesting things to hold side by side. I suppose what's also notable to me is George Martin, who wrote the Game of Thrones series, he holidays around here, and apparently a lot of it's based on the landscape around here. So you also have this weird overlays of Game of Thrones, John McGarren, W.B. Yeats, even Michael Harding, then June Caldwell, Kevin Barry, all these different versions of what this landscape is about and how it functions.
Kevin welcomes us to his house near the town of Ballymote. It's an area he believes to be possessed of a strange energy, not far from the caves of Caish in the Brickleave Mountains, where a mouth into hell is said to have opened. Benji the Rant's home is reportedly not far from the site.
Just as we talk now, I'm trying to remember when I first came across him. It must have been kind of 91 or 92. I started to come across this fellow who was always known as Benji the Rant. I'd never came up with a surname for him, but he would show up at kind of the illicit dance music gatherings that used to happen at that time, which were called raves in the west of Ireland around Connemara and Clare and West Cork.
It was at one of these raves that Kevin witnessed Benji channeling cosmic reverberations into spoken word performances. He called them rants.
A rant, it would be something like he would literally rant, and he might very often be accompanied by drums, and this would be at 6 or 7 or 8 o'clock in the morning, with the music having more or less ended. And he would just be kind of channeling. And I mean, one of the things you start to realise about writing, the longer you do it, is it's only close to one other thing in life, which is dreaming, because they come from the same place. It comes from the same subconscious places. And all writers in whatever form really are trying to just get out of the way of themselves in a way and just leave the material come directly through from the subconscious. And he seemed to have very, very easy access to his own subconscious places. And sometimes it would make sense, and sometimes it would just make kind of abstract sense, and sometimes it would make no sense at all. I mean, what was going on at the time was the raves and the traveller gatherings were banned by the Thatcher and the major governments in the UK. So a lot of the crusties, as they were called, started coming and settling in the west of Ireland, in places like Cool Mountain in West Cork, and all over Clare and Connemara, wherever they weren't moved on too quickly.
The exiled New Age traveller raves were open to all. Nomadic sound system crews provided the music and blared out tunes from home-built speaker stacks. One crew, known as Spiral Tribe, spotted Benji in full flow and adopted him as one of their own.
I have a vivid memory of sleeping in somebody's caravan in kind of the yard of kind of an abandoned farm in County Clare. And it was surrounded by dogs. There was all these dogs around. And it was 6 or 7 in the morning, I'd say, and it was winter in January. And there was nothing to be heard. The wind coming across. It was someplace in North Clare, I think. Just the wind coming across and the dogs outside held on chains and the chains rattling. And Benji was still going for it inside, you know. He was, and there was no one else around, but he was still sort of ranting inside in the house. And it would have been about, you know, maybe that's the time the first time I heard him going on about the treaded pulse, as he used to call it.
The idea of a pulse is referenced in most of the material we have of Benji. It's probably best explained as a vibration of the land, which is channeled through the rant.
Because all I could hear at that point was like a kind of a treaded pulse that was running along beneath the skin of the earth. A kind of a treaded pulse that would resound in my spinal area like a heavily dubbed bass line. And it was all that I could hear, and I could hear no more.
It's believed Benji left Ireland and travelled across Europe with Spiral Tribe during the 1990s. The record goes blank, however, until 2008, when news reaches Kevin that Benji has bought a cottage in the Brickleaves. Repeated attempts to contact Benji were firmly rebuffed.
I do think there is something very special about this part of the country, and the sense that there's hidden forces or people who might have a plumb line to something that you're not quite sure how they get that plumb line or how they get that access.
It's definitely got the sense around here, around there, and in particular up around the Brickleaves, I think, have been very thin ground, you know. I kind of feel that there are kind of patches of hillside and corners of fields and bits of road around here that give off very intense reverberations of mood and feeling. And I don't believe that feeling is something that just exists in humans and stays within us. You know, I think it seeps out and it goes into landscape and seascape and streetscape, and it remains behind. And I think often writers and artists and musicians, when they're trying to make something, all they're doing is trying to make something in response to a feeling given off by a place. And it seems to me around here a very, very, very rich place in terms of strange vibrations to respond to.
One thing that came up in my mind was, you know, often when people are thinking about the Northwest, they're thinking about Yeats, and they're thinking about that entire tourist trail, and it's very, very focused on Yeats. And I think that there's a different tradition that you and I are talking about in terms of the landscape. It's not this Celtic revival. It's a relative of that, but it has its own type of energy and its own type of texture.
Yeah, no, I'd absolutely agree with that. But at the same time, I wouldn't necessarily eliminate Yeats from it entirely.
No, definitely not.
In lots of ways, I see him as the original Krusty. Uh-huh. He used to buy tincture of cannabis from the pharmacy, from the chemist shop in Sligo Town, which was then legal. And he would roll around naked, stoned as a coot, on the beach at Ross's Point. And if ever a fellow is attuned to the treaded pulse that was going on beneath the Sligo ground.
As for Benji, it's known that he still practices occult sonic experiments in the Brickleaves. Details are sketchy, however.
It's interesting to me that he landed on Keshill finally, you know, that he was drawn back up there. I mean, those are some of the oldest human settlements in Europe. When somebody like Benji is kind of retreating to an original place and going back to the sources and going back to the caves on Keshill, I think we should all pay attention. I wonder why he's doing that and why he's doing it now.
I'm coming to the end of my travels, but there's still one last group that I want to speak to. I guess they're the inheritors of Aisteach, and probably the best test of its mission. And the representatives in this case are the second year music class of St. Raphaela's Secondary School in Dublin. It's a rainy January morning and I arrive soaked. But if I have a whiff of student teacher out of his depth about me, the students are very good at pretending not to notice.
Has anyone heard of Caoimhín Branach, who I'll be talking about later? No? No? Okay, it's not really surprising because these people were very, very obscure. So if we go to the top here and we look at this word, I've got the little finger thing over here. Ashtuk. Does anyone know what that word means? Anyone?
Tears, no? Trace?
Yeah.
Oh.
Who?
Irish scholar.
Do you know what it means? Okay. So Ashtuk kind of means, it means strange or weird. So it's a translation of strange or weird.
I play them Cuivín Brathnach's subliminal tape 21 to see what they think.
I think it sounded like something was burning and then there was like bombs going off in the background and then some other stuff as well.
It's like more like sounds instead of like instruments. And it sounds like someone just like put like a recording outside and then just like recorded what like was out there instead of like actually composing it.
I feel like it's kind of, yeah, it is rainfall, but I feel like there's more to it than just rain because it does sound like there's fireworks in the back of it.
Brilliant, yeah.
And it's like, yeah, it sounds like someone's dropping heavy things in a bucket of water because of the big splashes.
We end up talking about the work of Ashtuk and the power that an archive has over the present. I asked the students to do an exercise, to choose one object to put in an archive of themselves.
The Hunger Games trilogy.
My phone.
My skateboard.
My diary.
My diary.
A picture of me and my friends from Geltocht.
My favourite book.
Chess piece.
My dog's lashes.
A forget-me-not flower.
Their responses made things a bit simpler for me. I started to think that an archive, most of all, is really a piece of connective temporal tissue between people. And it only stays alive when you listen closely enough to hear something of yourself in the artwork.
Ashtuk is very reassuring because it brings to light a whole load of outsider artists who had no access to infrastructure and yet managed to plow their own furrow and produce original and worthwhile work.
Constructing or reconstructing lives like Zaftig's gives us a way to get to those people and gives us a way to sort of see our own past lives and to understand ourselves in a much deeper and richer sense.
So what can we do to shape a cultural legacy? Well, I'll leave that to Jennifer.
Artists, you know, artists work in strange and mysterious ways. And if we're curious and if we try not to be shy and we ask them questions, usually they're only dying to let us in and only dying to, like, help us find our way to understand their work. But don't feel shy to ask the artists questions because they're probably just dying to meet somebody who's curious. And ultimately, that's the way we should walk through life. It's what we expect children to be open and curious to things. There is something that's bigger than all of us that we plug into in different ways, whether it's a field or a threaded pulse or a collective unconsciousness or folklore. And that maybe there's something comforting in that, to think that there's something that's much bigger than us that we're all attached to in different ways because we can find commonality with people. And maybe if we're lucky, we can plug into it in little moments and feel the ground getting thin under our feet and letting that be a beautiful, ecstatic melting into something larger than us.
Stranger Than We Thought was presented and produced by Tom Rosengrave. For more on Jennifer Walsh's Ashtuk archive, see ashtuk.org. The lyric feature is available as a podcast from the RTE radio player and from wherever else you might get your podcasts. You can contact the programme by email features.lyricfm@rte.ie.